content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Religion News Service. And we'll begin today with an article entitled, Israel Says It Will Halt Several Aid Organizations' Operations in Gaza Starting in 2026. This was written by Melanie Lidman for the Associated Press. Israel, on December 30th, said it had suspended more than two dozen humanitarian organizations, including Doctors Without Borders and CARE, from operating in the Gaza Strip for failing to comply with new registration rules. Israel said the rules are aimed at preventing Hamas and other militant groups from infiltrating the aid organizations. But the organizations say the rules are arbitrary and warned that the new ban would harm a civilian population desperately in need of humanitarian aid. Israel has claimed throughout the war that Hamas was siphoning off aid supplies, a charge the UN and aid groups have denied. The new rules announced by Israel early this year require aid organizations to register the names of their workers and provide details about funding and operations in order to continue working in Gaza. The new regulations included ideological requirements, including disqualifying organizations that have called for boycotts against Israel, denied the October 7th attack, or expressed support for any of the international court cases against Israeli soldiers or leaders. Israel's Ministry of Diaspora Affairs said that more than 30 groups, about 15% of the organizations operating in Gaza, had failed to comply and that their operations would be suspended. It also said that Doctors Without Borders, one of the biggest and best-known groups in Gaza, had failed to respond to Israeli claims that some of its workers were affiliated with Hamas or Islamic Jihad. The message is clear. Humanitarian assistance is welcome. The exploitation of humanitarian frameworks for terrorism is not, Diaspora Affairs Minister Amiche Shikli said. Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, said Israel's decision would have a catastrophic effect on their work in Gaza, where they support around 20% of the hospital beds and a third of births. The organization also denied Israel's accusations about their staff. MSF would never knowingly employ people engaged in military activity, it said. While Israel claimed the decision would have limited impact on the ground, the affected organization said the timing, less than 3 months into a fragile ceasefire, was devastating. Despite the ceasefire, the needs in Gaza are enormous, and yet we and dozens of other organizations are and will continue to be blocked from bringing the essential life-saving assistance, said Shana Lowe, communications advisor for the Norwegian Refugee Council, which has also been suspended. Not being able to send staff into Gaza means all of the workload falls on our exhausted local staff, Lowe said. Some aid groups say they didn't submit the list of Palestinian staff as Israel demanded for fear they'd be targeted by Israel and because of data protection laws in Europe. It comes from a legal and safety perspective. In Gaza, we saw hundreds of aid workers get killed, Lowe explained. The decision not to renew aid groups' licenses mean offices in Israel and East Jerusalem will close, and organizations won't be able to send international staff or aid into Gaza. According to the ministry, the decision means the aid groups will have their license revoked on January 1st, and if they are located in Israel, they will need to leave by March 1st. They can appeal the decision. The Israeli defense body that oversees humanitarian aid to Gaza Kogat, C-O-G-A-T, said that the organizations on the list contribute less than 1% of the total aid going into the Gaza Strip, and that aid will continue to enter from more than 20 organizations that did receive permits to continue operating. The registration process is intended to prevent the exploitation of aid by Hamas, which in the past operated under the cover of certain international aid organizations, knowingly or unknowingly, COGAT said in a statement. This isn't the first time Israel has tried to crack down on international humanitarian aid organizations. Throughout the war, Israel accused the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, of being infiltrated by Hamas, using its facilities and taking aid. The United Nations has denied it. UNRWA, the top UN agency working with Palestinians, has denied knowingly aiding armed groups and says it acts quickly to purge any suspected militants. After months of criticism from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right allies, Israel banned UNRWA from operating on its territory in January. The U.S., formerly the largest donor to UNRWA, halted funding to that agency in early 2024. Israel failed to confirm that the data collected from the new regulations wouldn't be used for military or intelligence purposes, raising serious security concerns, said Athena Rayburn, the executive director of AIDA, an umbrella organization representing over 100 organizations that operate in the Palestinian territories. She noted that more than 500 aid workers have been killed in Gaza during the war. Agreeing for a party to the conflict to vet our staff, especially under the conditions of occupation, is a violation of humanitarian principles, specifically neutrality and independence, she said. Rayburn said organizations expressed their concerns and offered alternatives to submitting staff lists, such as third-party vetting, but that Israel refused to engage in any dialogue. Next, New York's religious hate crimes can be prevented through building bridges, city official says. This was written by Richa Karmarkar. After 1 year as executive director of the New York City Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes, Queens native and Hindu Viha Ramjetan feels hopeful. At a time of rising hate incidents against some religious and ethnic communities, Ramjetan's aim has been to build relationships and education from the bottom up, long before harm occurs. Through bread-breaking initiatives, such as the Interfaith Council for Symbols and Words of Peace and Hate, which launched early this year, Ramjetan wants to combat ignorance and show that shared knowledge is the city's greatest strength. He credits his approach in part for a recent decrease in hate crimes in the city. The perception that New Yorkers from diverse groups don't want to speak with each other, don't want to connect, don't want to exchange ideas or find places of commonality, that's not true, he told Religion News Service in an interview on December 17th. We just have to provide the space and the context for diverse New Yorkers to connect and build bridges. The program of the Interfaith Council for Symbols and Words of Peace and Hate was designed to bring together over 30 faith leaders who would not ordinarily be in the same room, or who might not otherwise stay in their own corners because of differences. We've been meeting every 3 months to talk about words and symbols that represent hate and those that represent peace. We saw that when we brought them together, they connected on a different level. We know that dialogue does not erase differences, but it does create understanding. And when that happens, fear gives way to shared values like dignity and safety for all. Oftentimes, when a person wants to express hate toward a group, they go to places where people find community, where they find peace, where they gather. Many times, those places are houses of worship. People use and twist symbols and narratives to carry emotions of hate toward different groups. And when that happens, it doesn't just affect one house of worship. It affects the entire community. The first gathering took place at a Buddhist temple in Chinatown. We chose that location because one of the symbols in the Buddhist community is the Manji sign, which looks like a swastika, but faces in the opposite direction. We also know that the symbol represents power, purity, and energy for Hindus. At the same time, we recognize that symbols can be twisted to represent hate in other contexts, which is a misrepresentation. This gathering became a way to share knowledge, bringing diverse community leaders and faith leaders together to discuss these symbols, how different communities understand and celebrate them, and how we can remain open to learning from one another. The second gathering was held at the Village Temple in Manhattan, where we continued these conversations. And the most recent gathering was very recently at the Bhakti Center in Manhattan. We know we can't speak to every single New Yorker, 8.5 million people, every day or all at once. But when we connect with faith leaders, professors, and organization heads from different faiths, when we speak to them and educate them about how we are trying to solve, curb, and prevent hate crimes in New York City, they take that knowledge back to their communities. We're able to reach hundreds of thousands of people across New York City by educating a smaller group. What's also important is that they value the fact that allyship is being built before an incident happens. Historically, when an incident occurs, we then look for our allies who can stand with us and say, "We denounce this. We stand with the affected community." Sometimes we don't find people and our neighbors aren't there for us. But if we build this allyship, this understanding and this network of community ahead of time, then when one of us is harmed or targeted, we can all stand together and say, "No, that's wrong." The point of this whole effort is that when we can all agree that one symbol represents peace and another represents hate, we have consensus. And when those symbols or words are used, we can stand together and say, "No, we all agree this is an act of hate, bias, or discrimination." What we've shown in New York City is that we can stand in solidarity with each other when we celebrate Hanukkah, when we celebrate Eid, when we celebrate Diwali, and still be who we are authentically. I can show up without having to travel to Mecca, Israel, or India to experience these traditions. We can experience them right here. We can simply go to each other, to our neighbors, in our buildings, on our blocks, in our churches or community spaces, and ask questions. We see symbols and signs everywhere. Our office here has learned through our various programs that if we just take 2 seconds to understand someone, we can appreciate them. We have so many opportunities to do that. We just have to provide the spaces and the resources for communities to come together, build understanding and appreciation, and celebrate our diversity. New York City has provided an opportunity for communities to be authentic. I can walk down Liberty Avenue, I can walk in Manhattan, with my talik, my kurta, my scarf, and be me, and be welcomed, right? A Jewish person can wear their religious garments and be their authentic self. That is beautiful. But when there are those who find ways to express whatever emotional things they're going through because it's an easy target, to me it's unfortunate that the number of incidents are what they are for the Jewish community. but we are doing so much programming to prevent the next victim. Over the years, we've seen a consistent trend. The majority of reported hate crimes are anti-Semitic and target the Jewish community. We have to learn something from that. I always tell people, if I'm doing my job well, hate crime numbers will go up because we're educating people about what a hate crime is, and then they'll know it to report it. So when I see the numbers, yes, it's sad, but at least now people know. Back in the day, people didn't report because they didn't know what a hate crime was. The Jewish community has done a great job in terms of reporting. We lead, we react, and we respond to preventing hate crimes every day, every second. We also know that Islamophobia, Hindu phobia, Sikh phobia, anti-Semitism, and other phobias and isms are reasons why hate crimes happen. What we've been doing is providing deep, in-depth education across New York City through programming. We go to schools and speak to young people in elementary school, middle school, high school to educate them on these differences, how to identify them, and how to report them. We cannot arrest our way out of hate crimes. We have to educate our way forward. We have to invest in healing. We are here to serve New Yorkers, and we are here to fulfill their needs and to make sure that if New Yorkers feel safe so that everyone can coexist in New York City. We welcome Mayor Mamdani, his leadership, and his guidance, and we look forward to following his initiatives. Diversity in leadership is beautiful. It's also beautiful to have his perspective and his lens of how he wants the city to respond to hate crimes, and how we here can make the adjustments needed to meet his goals, his vision, and to mirror that. We know that New Yorkers want to collaborate, and we want to continue doing that. That was important for us this past year, letting people know that there's an office of this kind for this purpose, but also being aware that that's not enough. We have to turn it into action, and the action is one person at a time, one community at a time, one neighborhood at a time. We are looking forward to doing this next year under the new administration. Our next story is a commentary by Reverend Jonathan Hall, who is senior pastor of First Christian Church of North Hollywood, California. This is entitled, Keep Christ in Christmas. First, keep Christ in Christian. I recognize we're already in the second week of January, but I thought this was well worth hearing. Each December we hear a well-meant admonition, keep Christ in Christmas. I affirm that plea with my whole heart. The season of Christ's birth should not be swallowed up by anxiety about gifts, shipping dates, or should the manger in Bethlehem be drowned in tinsel and emptied of wonder. But there is a quieter, graver danger that does not wait for December and does not end when the lights come down, taking the Christ out of Christian. That happens whenever we subtract empathy from discipleship, whenever self narrows our field of vision until we can no longer see the plight of our neighbor. Empathy is not a soft substitute for holiness. It is the pulse of the Christian and the Christmas story. To call it a sin is to confuse the selfishness of self with the self-giving love of Jesus. The irony, of course, is ancient. Many in Jesus' day grew angry precisely because his heart was too open. He touched those deemed untouchable, ate with those labeled unworthy, healed on days deemed inconvenient, and noticed people that others learned not to see. The complaint then, even from his own disciples, was that he was too near to the wrong people. The complaint now in some corners is that Christians are, quote, sinfully empathetic, end quote. The attitude lingers, even as the Gospels show us a Savior moved in his very gut by the pain before him. If we let it, the season offers a gentle epiphany, a revelation about how God draws near. Consider a simple sorrow-touched holiday tale, Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Match Girl. A child, shivering in the snow, tries to sell matches as passersby hurry past, their errands louder than her hunger. She lights the matches one by one for a moment's warmth. In the final flickering glow, she sees the grandmother who loved her, and the story ends with a reunion in a place where compassion is not scarce. Andersen's tale is morose and melodious at once, a winter parable about our capacity to look away. Yet it is also about a tender hope that refuses to die. It asks each of us softly but insistently, would I have stopped? Would I have knelt? Or would I have tightened my scarf and quickened my step? These questions are not meant to shame, they are meant to awaken. Empathy is the discipline of pausing long enough to imagine, what if that were me? What if that were my child? It is not agreement with every choice. It is the willingness to feel another's ache long enough to ask what love requires. Jesus models this over and over. When a woman accused of adultery is surrounded by those who would stone her to death, Jesus stills the violence first, then points her toward a better life. He touched the lepers before he healed them, restoring a human bond before restoring skin. With the hungry crowd, he fed them not because they proved worthy of bread, but because they were hungry. Such empathy is not weakness. It is holiness with hands. There is, to be sure, a temptation in every age to harvest the political or social capital of Christianity without undertaking the cruciform work. In subtle ways, we can turn Jesus is Lord into Jesus is useful, wearing the mantle of faith as a veneer for our own authority. The Roman Emperor Constantine tried to do as much, draping the cross in the colors of power. We need to ask which way our loyalty bends, toward self-sacrifice or toward fear and force. The answer will be revealed not by our slogans, but by our readiness to feel and to serve. Empathy can be costly. It unsettles our schedules. It tugs at our resources. It asks us to carry one another's burden. But the answer is compassion fatigue. The answer to compassion fatigue is not compassion famine. Christmas itself is God's gentle declaration that empathy is not a sin, but the shape of divine love. Emmanuel, God with us, means God refuses to love from a safe altitude. Beautifully poetic, God learns our language, enters our sorrows, and, in Jesus, weeps at a friend's grave. If the cradle sanctifies anything, it sanctifies nearness. The cross confirms it. Love does not stand at the edge of the suffering with folded arms. It steps toward the wounded and calls them neighbor. Please keep Christ in Christmas, but do not stop there. Keep Christ in Christian. Keep the tenderness that touches the untouchable, the patience that listens to the silenced, the mercy that moves from feeling to action. Empathy is the furthest thing from a sin. It is the soil in which Christian love takes root. For a Christianity that cannot feel will soon fail to love. And a church that trades empathy for power may gain the world and lose the Christ whose name it bears. Next, U.S. Jewish organizations call on Trump to rescind travel ban on Palestinians. This was written by Yonat Shimron. 8 U.S. Jewish organizations have written a letter to President Donald Trump urging him to rescind the most recent travel ban, especially its restriction on Palestinians, with documents issued by the Palestinian Authority. The new ban, which Trump issued on December 16th, blocks travel to the U.S. for people from Syria, South Sudan, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, as well as people traveling with Palestinian Authority documents, essentially most Palestinians in the West Bank. More than 35 countries are now under U.S. travel restrictions. American Jewish groups committed to an Israeli-Palestinian peace settlement are particularly concerned that banning Palestinians from the country might undermine the United States' role as peacemaker. Your administration has publicly asserted an interest in stabilizing the Gaza ceasefire and preventing a return to widespread violence. Yet this policy moves in the opposite direction, the letter said. By further restricting Palestinian travel and engagement, the proclamation weakens and delegitimizes the Palestinian Authority at a moment when its credibility, capability, and international support are essential. The letter was written by a group, New Jewish Narrative, and co-signed by Bend the Ark, Jewish Action, J Street, the National Council of Jewish Women, the New York Jewish Agenda, Partners for Progressive Israel, Turaha, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, and the Workers' Circle. A travel ban, the letter argues, further weakens the Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the West Bank. The U.S. is claiming to take this role of peacemaker there in the region, which includes the realization of obvious need for rebuilding Palestinian institutions there, said Hadar Suskind, president and CEO of the New Jewish Narrative. For the U.S. to say, oh yes, we want to make it better, we want to make peace, we want to rebuild Palestinian institutions, and then to take this action, is first and foremost going to have a real impact on people's lives in terms of their ability to come here. But beyond that, politically speaking, it's yet another blow to undermine the Palestinian Authority. Trump and his top advisors have argued that the restrictions are necessary to protect national security, but he has also shown disdain for immigrants. After last month's shooting of two National Guard troops, Trump vowed to permanently pause migration from all third world countries. The letter written to him says this measure does not target specific individuals who pose a credible threat. Instead, it forecloses access for students, medical patients, civil society actors, and family members based solely on the documents available to them. At a moment of profound humanitarian need and regional instability, this policy further restricts already limited avenues for lawful travel and engagement. It compounds harm to civilians while doing nothing to advance security. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading.